some magical pill could deliver all the necessary nutrients in perfectly calibrated amounts, sparing us all the time, money, and effort we spend on food, nobody would take that deal. Food is so much more to us than calories and vitamins. It's pleasure and culture and heritage. But we can't truly experience legacy recipes if all our ingredients are generic monocultural varietals grown for the ease of farming and the ability to survive the long journey to the grocery store. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest believes it is vital that we find ways to conserve threatened food sources for their biodiversity in a fast-changing climate and for their links to the past in our fast-changing civilization. Sarah Lohman is a food historian and author. Her new book is called Endangered Eating, America's Vanishing Foods. Sarah, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
So you write that you had always thought about American cuisine as constantly expanding to include new dishes. You know, we're all familiar maybe with different foodways than we had been decades ago. How did you start to realize, though, that a lot of American food ingredients have actually been disappearing from what's available to us?
You know, it was through coming across an article that was actually in BBC Travel, and it was about the world's rarest pasta. This pasta is called Sufilindeu. It's made by maybe half a dozen women in Sardinia. Traditionally, they had to be from the same family. And if you want to try it, you can only do so twice a year after you complete, I think, a 37-kilometer pilgrimage across the mountains of Sardinia. So, of course, that's all very evocative and fascinating, but the reason this article was being written is because it was featuring this thing called the Arc of Taste. The Arc of Taste is put together by Slow Food International, and it's an online encyclopedia of rare, delicious, distinctive foods that are on the verge of extinction. And so I started going down the rabbit hole with that. And that's what really led to me this idea of, oh, my gosh, you know, it's not just the idea that in America, there's an American specific list that, you know, we have different patterns of migration and immigration. Our cuisine keeps building. There are also all these foodways here that are being lost, but also are being preserved by the people who love them. So that was the starting point for me.
Just so that everybody's clear off the top here. An item that goes on to the Arc of Taste and is being featured so that it can be saved. This is not about eating the last remaining example of some threatened animal species or
no.
Food. Can you kind of help us understand what that means?
Yeah, absolutely. Like the Arc of Taste basically has two ideas. There's eat it to save it and save it to eat it. Eat it to save it is really more for our domesticated animals, farm animals, and crops. So like it could be as simple as planting the seeds of a rare tomato, like a rare heirloom tomato, or it can be a little bit more complicated involving, you know, buying salmon from a traditional fishing community in the Pacific Northwest. The flip side of that, though, is the list also contains foraged plants, you know, wild plants and wild animals and fish. And the key there is to make sure we're preserving those items so that we can continue to eat it for generations to come. So the focus there is on responsible harvesting, sustainability, and really each one of these items might have some unique needs that that are highlighted within the Arc of Taste.
I love the mantra, eat it to save it. Can you talk a little bit about what qualifies an ingredient to end up on Slow Food International's Arc of Taste?
Sure. So Slow Food is international, but they have chapters at regional and local levels. So let's say, for example, I currently live in Nevada, which now that I think of it, I don't know if they're in the Pacific chapter or the Southwest chapter. We're sort of a weird area, right? Or we could say Texas, right? So you're in the Southwest chapter, but there's also a Texas chapter. And then there's also a chapter for probably every large city or region in Texas. And those chapters are headed up by volunteers who are coordinating the efforts to recognize, you know, usually highly local foods. They don't always necessarily have to be almost endangered, but perhaps some of them are considered rare because they are so local. They should be culturally important. They should be delicious. They should be copyright free and available for anyone to raise or grow if they want to. And then there's a process of really sort of like submitting an item, doing research on it, doing a write-up on it. And eventually that goes all the way up the ladder to Italy, who approves the entry into the Ark of Taste. Then it goes on this online encyclopedia, and the main goals there are getting the word out, encouraging people to explore food on a local level, or if they're not traveling, perhaps purchase this food from local growers and getting it shipped to where they are.
All right, let's dive in here. How did California's Coachella Valley become the date capital of the United States? And I don't mean Tinder dates, I mean fruit dates.
Yes, fruit dates. I mean, it's such a surprising thing, right? We definitely think of Coachella as this now music capital, right? Or maybe we think of Palm Springs, which is also in the area. But 50 or 60 years ago, people thought about date palms. So it became the date growing region in America because the climate is very similar to the Arabian Peninsula, where a lot of dates are grown. And during the early 20th century, we were in this sort of like almost like food, you know, colonialization mode, where we were pulling foods from all over the planet and seeing what could grow here and seeing what crops could be beneficial for American farmers. So it was proposed to try a date industry in the Coachella Valley. The dates grew, the industry took off, and really even by the 20s or 30s, it was known as our date growing capital. Today, there are fewer small family farms, and that's really what this chapter focuses on, because it's on those small farms in the early 20th century that unique American date varieties were developed, grown, and sold. So we really want to think about dates aren't a native crop, but you know, now we have these species grown nowhere else, and it's interesting to both support small farms and preserve these unique dates.
Yeah, I realized reading your book that I don't know that I've tasted a wide variety of date varietals. What did you learn about how different one strain can be from another when you visited this place called Sam Cobb Farms?
Oh my gosh. So, I mean, I don't think most Americans have, unless perhaps you're of a background where you might come from Northern Africa, the Arabian Peninsula, or maybe South Asia. And of course, those immigrant groups are growing and their kids are now growing up here. So date eating culture is becoming a much broader part of American food culture. You'll see it grow now that we've talked about it. But I think most of us are just familiar with maybe medjools, you know, plump, fruity, kind of soft, or maybe a Deglet Nor. But there are dates that are called semi-sweet. So like, I think a medjool is just so sweet. I love a semi-sweet date. And they tend to just be like a little more caramel-like as opposed to just sweet sugar. And also there are dry dates too. So there are ones that are a little bit more like taffy. And there's even ones that are a little bit like leathery too. In the 19th century, they'd always say, that the dry date varieties, you could carry them in your pocket without a package, which I always think is so funny. you know, that their selling point was that you could load them up in your pocket, which I guess you can't do with a medjool. So that's fair. So there, and then there's so many different flavors from, you know, something that is a little bit crunchy with sugar crystals and caramel to something that is really fruity to something that's more smoky. And even at Sam Cobb, who is a new generation small farmer developing new date varieties, not even these early 20th century ones, he fed me a date called Safari that even tasted savory, which is unlike anything I'd had before. So really, if you're in Coachella, you know, the ask is just look up a local grower like Sam Cobb, who has his farm stand open on Saturdays, but you can also order online. Ditto Shields or Oasis Date Gardens, which are old school ones. And there's also Rancho Meloduco, which is a newer one as well. And they've all got these fascinating date varieties. It's just like a fun food adventure to have, whether you're there or whether you want to buy some as a treat for the holidays.
So where some people might want to do a wine tasting, you could theoretically do a date tasting.
Or how about a cider tasting? Mm. We get into that in one of the other chapters, too.
Yeah, cider's so interesting. So, I mean, even a fancy grocery store in this country might have 6 or 8 kinds of apples at any given time. There are about 100 commercially grown apple varietals in this country. But that is like the tiniest fraction of apples that exist, right?
Yeah, this is unbelievable, but there was an agricultural bulletin put together in the early 20th century. It's like 1909, 1907, something like that. And it was to categorize all of the known apple varieties. It listed 14,000 different American apple varieties. And today we only grow about 100 commercially. So the difference is during Prohibition in the 1920s, we shifted away, we sort of limited the number of apples that were sold in the grocery store at that time. The Apple, you know, Association just thought it would be simpler for advertising. And it was also when there was a push to associate apples with like health and snacks. The phrase "an apple a day keeps the doctor away" came about in Prohibition. And this is all attached to Prohibition because most apples before the 1920s were used to make hard cider, which from now on I'm just going to call cider because that's what the rest of the world calls it. And the unfermented stuff is called sweet cider. So we lost a lot of those apples because we lost a lot of that drinking culture in America.
So you explain in the book that apples are extreme heterozygotes. What does that mean exactly? Yeah.
Okay, so a lot of fruits are similar in that you can't plant the seed of an apple and get the same type of apple growing from that seed. Dates are actually the same. You can't plant the pit of a date and get the same date palm. It's like if we have a child, not you and me necessarily, but you know, if I have a child with someone, if you have a child with someone, that child's not going to be an exact copy of us, right? So most fruit trees and drupes, which is what a date is, work the same way. They are a combination. The seeds contain a combination of genetics from both parents. We get exact copies of something like an apple or a date or a citrus tree by growing from a cutting of the original tree. So apples are known as extreme heterozygotes because every apple has five seeds, and every one of those seeds has a different combination of genetic information. And every apple tree has hundreds, maybe thousands of apples. So every tree is carrying potentially an incredible amount of genetic combinations and information. So if you plant every one of those seeds, you will get 1,000 different apple trees. This allowed apples to adapt really quickly to America or any other place they were taken from their native home, which is actually in Kazakhstan. And it's their survival mechanism. They adapt, and then apples, you know, we're really not American as apple pie. They're, apple trees are not from here, but they are now because we have these hyper localized specialized varieties that adapted themselves to our climate.
How is the cider brand Angry Orchard trying to revive the production of endangered apple varietals?
Oh my gosh, this is so cool, I think, because most people are probably familiar with Angry Orchard. They're, you know, the best known cider brand out there. And you can go up to your local grocery store and pick up a 6-pack of their commercial releases. But in addition to their national distribution, they also have like a very small brand, you know, local cider house in Walden, New York. And it is a place where they ferment. There's a tasting room, you know, there's a beautiful outside area, and it all sits in the middle of an orchard that is planted with old apple trees, with heirloom apple trees. And so outside of their commercial varieties, they're doing all kinds of cool experiments with fermentation and apples. And they work with often rare heirloom apples as well. Like the Newtown Pippin is the one that I focus on in my book, which is also an apple that is local to New York. It was created in Elmhurst, Queens on Long Island. So they are making a single varietal with the Newtown Pippin. And it's not the same every year. That's the fun. It's like a good wine from Napa Valley. You know, same apple, but growing conditions and climate and how they blend the fermentation, it's going to be a little different. And they also sell it in a champagne-style bottle, too. So it just is a very special, fun experience to buy one of their unique ciders up there.
Just to go back for a minute, Sarah, to the many apple varieties that exist in this country, it has been an uphill battle. I mean, they grow wild in a lot of places, but I think in the book we learned that 471,000 acres of farmland just in New York State has been lost to real estate development in recent years.
Yeah, and what's crazy about that is although there are unique apple varieties all over the country, in the book I focus on New York and New Jersey. And, you know, New Jersey once was famous for its cider making. And even at the turn of the 20th century, I was reading articles talking about, you know, where are our orchards? Where are our famous apple trees? There are houses now where those trees once stood. So, you know, in terms of development in that part of the country, it has been apparently pretty constant for the last 100 years in terms of replacing farms and orchards and turning them into housing developments.
Why did we lose our taste for cider as a country? Is it just that we now have many more alcoholic beverages available?
I mean, that's part of it. But, you know, really, it has to do with two big factors. One is that in the middle of the 19th century, there was a large German immigration. It's still, Germans are very much a part of America's cultural heritage. One in every four Americans has German heritage, me included. I know there's a big Texas German population, too.
Yeah.
With the Germans came beer. Americans had ale, the sort of heavier English style of brewing, but the Germans brought lager beer, and the alcohol percentage was lower. And more importantly, it's cold. You serve it cold, and that just like really hit in America. And at the same time, this big German immigration brought this new brewing style. We were becoming more of an urbanized country, and it was just much easier to process grain in cities and make beer than it was to ship apples into cities and make cider. Cider is really an agricultural product, not an industrial product. So that's part of it. And the other one I hinted at a little bit, it is the temperance movement, which started the 19th century. And honestly, I'm not down on the temperance movement. They did a lot of good, particularly in the 19th century, but its like endpoint was prohibition in the 1920s. And while it wasn't explicitly illegal to have apple trees and to turn them into cider on your own property, it was looked down upon. It was a little bit like, oh, why does so-and-so have apple trees? Are they drinking? Like, it was just sort of a moral nosiness. And so people were literally cutting down their apple trees in solidarity with the temperance movement. And so this is when we switched to grocery store eating apples and lost a lot of those cider apples and that cider drinking culture in America.
I was fascinated by your chapter on Hawaiian sugarcane, because this is really a story about plants and about people and about politics all at the same time. First of all, start with how sugarcane played into the colonization of the Hawaiian Islands by white foreigners in the first place.
Oh my gosh, Chris, such big questions. Absolutely. I mean, I should say too that a lot of this book is about indigenous communities. It's probably unsurprising once we stop to think about it that foods from indigenous communities can be, you know, teetering on extinction because of the actions of white colonists. So Hawaiian sugarcane is from Papua New Guinea, and that whole area of Pacific Islands are known as the Polynesian Triangle, and that is an area that was settled by the wayfinders, these ocean-going navigators from Polynesia. And so the northernmost point of the Polynesian Triangle is Hawaii. So Hawaii was settled around 1,000 years ago, and one of the crops that was brought there to help these new settlers was Hawaiian sugarcane. So Hawaiian sugarcane was growing there during first contact, which was in the late 18th century. Captain Cook came through, and pretty quickly missionaries and their children came to Hawaii and began investing in sugar refineries to take the juice of this native Hawaiian cane and produce white sugar from it. By the late 19th century, these sugar plantation owners had pretty much taken over the island politically, and they're the ones that pushed for Hawaii becoming a territory to be annexed by the United States. So it really was this whole power struggle with sugar in Hawaii that led to the overthrow of the native Hawaiian government and their status as an independent nation.
I hadn't realized, by the way, that sugarcane is actually a kind of very tall grass.
It is. It is the second largest member of the grass family. The largest is bamboo. And a lot of these native varieties of sugarcane, they look like bamboo, but also they can have pink and green stripes or be a deep dark purple with smoky rings. Like, there are over 40 at least native varieties, and they all look different, and they're all so gorgeous.
So there's no longer any sugarcane being grown commercially in Hawaii. Is that good or bad for the people there?
Well, it's sort of interesting. There are a few commercial growers today, but they are distillers. A couple people have popped up in the Hawaiian Islands that are making rum agricole. And rum agricole, regular rum is made from molasses. Rum agricole is fermented from pressed sugarcane juice. It was created in Martinique, which is another traditional sugar growing region, but because of colonization, the crop was brought there by white colonizers. Is it a good or a bad thing? I mean, if you ask two people in Hawaii, they will have two totally different opinions. One person I talked to, Dr. Noah Lincoln, who is a heirloom crop specialist at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, he's the one that provided the cuttings to these distillers because, his idea being connected to botany and agriculture is we have to preserve these plants. And the more places they're growing in, the better chance we have of preserving them. There could be a weather event, there could be real estate development, which is a big issue in Hawaii right now. If I know they're growing, no matter what they're being used for, then that makes sure that this part of Hawaii's history is preserved. I also talked to a farmer, Anthony Deleuze, and asked him what he thought of these distillers using this native sugarcane. And first he pointed out, these aren't native people, native Hawaiians owning these distilleries, are they? And I said, no. And he said, yeah, well, then I do think that's a problem because, of course, there are a lot of stereotypes about alcohol and native peoples, but all of the distilled alcohol is coming from the white colonizers, too. So, the use of alcohol within native communities and now this colonizer's product being made from native cane again, because white sugar was also a colonizer's product, other people see that as being very problematic. So it's, the answers of what to do to preserve these foods are not black and white. They're often very complicated.
But it speaks maybe to the importance of knowing what we're buying and where it comes from and who's profiting.
Absolutely. And I think just, connecting to the cultures, both around you where you live, but also where you're visiting, especially when we're talking about somewhere like Hawaii. Like, we need to be travelers, not tourists. We're still essentially visiting another person's country. And not all Hawaiians are happy about being part of America. We stole this land from them as we stole land from many native peoples. Food is a place where me as a white person, we can listen. We can get this inroad into a local community that is important. We can respect people through their food. We can support them through their food too. So I think it's about being responsible, being knowledgeable, but also using food as a way to connect with communities that you might not otherwise be able to and learning something new.
All right, let's jump back over to the continental United States. Tell us about the Navajo Churro sheep, which is one of the earliest domesticated animal breeds in the United States.
It is. So the Navajo Churro, so we're not entirely sure of the genetics. It was probably based on some of the earliest sheep breeds, brought over in the 16th century. And it's been with the Navajo people for somewhere around 400 years, and they've husbanded it into a just the stocky, tough little adorable little sheep that is built for the Southwest. Good foragers, good mothers, can survive a dry climate, and as well as having sweet and delicious meat, as even later in life, we tend to only eat lamb of other breeds, but you can eat older sheep of the Navajo Churro. They have this very special two-length wool that is ideal for hand weaving, and it's from these sheep that the wool comes from to make traditional Navajo blankets and weavings.
So these are more than just an interesting textile source and a food ingredient, right? These animals are culturally significant at this point to the Navajo Nation.
Yes, and I think that as far as indigenous foods that I talk about foods that are truly culturally significant. Hawaiian sugarcane also had many different ritual purposes, as well as being highly localized and developed to the many, many tiny climates present on the Hawaiian Islands. So the Navajo Churro sheep actually are part of the creation story of the Navajo people. And it's not really known if they were always there, and perhaps originally the story meant bighorn sheep, because domesticated sheep aren't native to America, or if the arrival of the sheep were so significant in the history of and the identity of the Navajo people that perhaps they were sort of added in later. Some people say that the story was always that way to make us ready, to make the Navajo people ready to receive the sheep when they came. So there is a spiritual partnership and identity, even if someone is living not in on the Navajo Nation, or even if someone is but is not a shepherd, the taste of the Navajo churro meat, that's home to a lot of people.
So why did the federal government start demanding the Navajo people reduce the size of their flocks of these sheep starting in the 1930s?
Yeah, and there, you know, it happened once before too in the 1860s. There was an attempt to move the Navajo people to a reservation away from their ancestral lambs, and a lot of sheep were lost or died in that process. Once they were returned, the Navajo got the numbers back up to about 1 million sheep. But it was this push and shove of railroad land and American cattle ranchers wanting the land that was traditionally used for Navajo grazing. And then after the Hoover Dam was finished, there was a concern about basically erosion in the Navajo Nation, building up silt in the Colorado River and potentially behind the Hoover Dam. So the Navajo government ordered the extermination of not just Navajo sheep, but also their goats and horses, which economically devastated and spiritually devastated the Navajo community.
We should be clear, Sarah, that when this land was cleared, it wasn't left empty. Grazing rights were then given over to cattle ranchers.
And that has always been the priority, you know, typically because cattle ranchers tended to be white Americans, while shepherds tend to be indigenous or Latin. So sometimes it sounds like a broken record that it all comes back to racial prejudice and colonization, but a lot of it does. And I also want to be clear, too, that, you know, indigenous people are here. They're resilient. They are, they take legal action. They're very legislative. And there are many people working to preserve traditional life ways and succeeding despite everything that the American government and European Americans have done to them.
I do want to touch on this. You visited on a day when a group of kindergarten and first grade students were taking a tour and shown a butchering demonstration. This is the kind of thing, I can't imagine the sort of pearl clutching that might happen among parents, but you feel like kids that young are able to comprehend what it means to understand where their meat comes from.
You know, of course, I was shocked, too, because these were tiny, tiny little kids. But I stopped and talked to the teachers and they said, yeah, we come every year. And they said, you know, about half of their students live on farms, so they see this process all the time. But the other half, they felt it was important to know where their meat is from. And I do think that it's unreasonable that we clutch pearls at the thought of not just our kids, but us having to butcher an animal or witness that process. And yet many of us eat meat every day. So for me, I think that it's very important to understand the sacrifice, even if I'm just eating some chicken nuggets, right? Like that was a little life. And so there is a certain amount of respect that comes from that. So I, for one, too, am very grateful for the opportunity to both witness and participate in butchering a whole ram, like I talk about in the book, because, you know, I'd never really had that experience before. And it makes me much more thoughtful about what I'm eating. Meat is animals, and we have lost the basic understanding of that.
Butchering is really physical work too, isn't it?
Oh my gosh. I mean, we slaughtered a ram and it basically took 2 days to break it all apart. And, you know, we ate everything except for the hooves, the skull. They actually, no, I take that back. They save for later. A couple internal organs, you know, that were unsafe essentially went into a pit and were buried. But, you know, one of the things we made is a favorite Navajo, or Dineh is the Navajo name for themselves. Like a really like beloved Dineh food is blood sausage. And that's blood mixed with corn, some spices, some herbs, and then packed into the intestines and some of the stomachs of the sheep. And people love it because it's a special food. You can only make it when a sheep has been freshly slaughtered. So it's, you know, kind of a rare treat, and it's rare to have it like really good and fresh like we made it that day.
Well, and when you talk about rare treat, I mean, we worry so much in this country about overconsumption of food products. If you've been this involved in how much work it takes to make a meat dish, you are probably not going to mindlessly eat more than you need.
I mean, I think about it a lot just from everything I've done in my career. When I first started out, I was blogging, and often I would find menus from the past that were connected to recipes, like how an Italian tenement family ate or how someone ate during the Panic of 1873. And I would put myself in that life, you know, and eat and make these foods for a week at a time. And the truth is that before, I mean, there's so much anti-convenience food talk, but I think people don't understand that pre-washed lettuce and pre-sliced bread and pre-portioned meat are all convenience foods too. If you were really thinking about how people cooked, you know, even maybe 70 years ago, once I finished one meal when I was doing these activities, these experiments, I was starting on the next one. So as a woman, you just spent so much of your time processing and cooking food. And now I appreciate the options we have that I can choose. That cooking's a hobby now, not a labor, not drudgery. And that's an amazing shift in our culture.
Sarah, just to be clear here, we're talking about things that are produced in relatively small quantities compared with, you know, big agricultural production of foods, a big industrial production. Do these things have to coexist? I mean, we wouldn't have enough food if we only ate these endangered foods at this point, right?
I mean, another huge question, Chris. I mean, I do think that they can coexist. I do think that it's important to think about how we get an equitable food system for all. I think that there is, in modern foodie culture, a lot of morality placed on eating local and eating organic and eating heirloom. And I hate that, to be really, really frank. I don't think we should put that morality in food, because our food system is both complicated and broken. And I do think that there is a place for some of these really delicious, you know, heirloom plants to come into our modern, you know, national, international food system. And that is great. But I also don't think that capitalism, you know, making money should be the be all and end all. I think that the more important part of wanting to engage with these foods is cultural preservation.
Okay, I want to talk about your exploration of reef net fishing because you
Sure.
learned there is no other commercial fishing process that is as selective or as gentle on the fish. What is so special about this technique?
Oh, it is amazing. It was invented probably 10,000 years ago or more, by the indigenous communities whose land border the Puget Sound and largely the Salish Sea, which is the northernmost part of the sound that crosses the international border with Canada. And as opposed to an open ocean method, they're set up in the sea and they're set up in the pathway of schooling salmon. The reef net gears are two floating platforms, or traditionally two canoes, with a net strung between them. And literally, a spotter, usually the captain of the ship, watches the water for the schooling salmon, gives the signal for when a salmon is when salmon are swimming into the net, and then the net is pulled up via winches and gears and just human strength onto those floating platforms. The fish are then put into a live well. That is a well that is filled with seawater to swim around and calm down. And that's the chance where you can pull any species of salmon or other fish that accidentally got in there. So this is an easy way to save protected species. I mean, a couple times while I was working in these reef net gears, we pulled a king or Chinook salmon, which are protected species. Those are the really big guys. And they're alive and unharmed. So we just cradled them out of the well in our arms and scooped them back into the ocean, and off they went to their traditional breeding grounds in fresh water. After the salmon swim around in the live well, then they're bled and put back in the water for them to die. And so, in a lot of fishing techniques, fish are either allowed to suffocate on deck or thrown directly on ice. That stress makes the meat taste off. So allowing the fish to feel safe and relaxed and have a good death also means that it's a very high quality product.
Sounds like what you don't get here is an unlimited quantity for, you know, 10 or 12 bucks a pound.
You certainly do not, but the primary salmon that is being advocated we eat more of is pink salmon. And if there's salmon lovers out there that are going, ugh, we have this really weird stereotype that pink salmon meat is too soft and it's only good for dog food. It's actually delicious. It doesn't stand up to the same high heat as other salmons, but once you learn a recipe or two, it is a delicious salmon. It's extremely sustainable because for an unknown reason, pink salmon are schooling in larger numbers now than they ever had before. So this is actually a really sustainable salmon species that should be eaten more and will help us preserve the salmon fishing industry as a whole.
So this book was a whole education for me in what wild rice is and is not.
Yes.
What did you learn from members of the Ojibwe Nation about this?
So same. I mean, there are hundreds of stories I could have picked, right? I landed on basically eight, but also a little story in my intro and conclusion too. And I picked ones that surprised me because I think number one surprise about wild rice is that it's not rice. Is that the one that surprised you
yeah,
too?
Absolutely.
Yes. It is, you know, the only thing that binds the two together is that rice, which comes from Asia, and wild rice, which comes from North America, largely around the Great Lakes. They're both grasses, you know, like sugarcane, like bamboo. But actually, wild rice's closest relative is corn. And when you see wild rice, you can see the resemblance. Like their flowers sort of look the same as a corn stalk too. I'm from Ohio originally, so we know corn out there. Anyone out there know what I'm talking about? But yeah, it's also surprised me because I'm from the Cleveland area on Lake Erie, and wild rice is native to the Great Lakes region. And that shocked me because I grew up there. I have family there, and I'd never heard of it there. So it sent me both on a journey to learn about the harvesting of this food that is sacred to the Ojibwe people who are part of the larger Anishinaabe tribal nation. And also just to try to seek it out in my own home. And you know, if I couldn't find it, figure out where it had gone and why.
So how is this stuff, it's not cultivated, it grows wild. How is this stuff gathered by people at harvest time?
In a canoe. So harvest time will start sometime in late August or September. It usually goes for a couple weeks. The grains on the rice don't ripen at the same time. So teams of ricers go out in canoes, and there is a poler and a knocker. And the poler steers the canoe through the shallow wild rice beds, kind of like a gondolier, you know, in Venice. And the knocker has these two cedar sticks that have very, especially in Minnesota, they have very specific regulations of these tools to help protect the wild rice. But they're a couple of feet long, and they use it to sort of part the grass of wild rice, which is just growing out of these mucky, shallow areas, bend it over the canoe, and then with the other knocker, they tap the end of the wild rice blade, essentially, and it knocks any of the ripe granules into the canoe. This process also means that some of the ripe seeds are going into the water as well, and that is reseeding the wild rice for the next year. So it's a wild plant, but its survival is very connected with human harvest.
So if people want to try this stuff and cook with it, what does it take to support demand for this food and be sure we're actually buying the authentic product that supports Indigenous communities?
Yeah, because, you know, even if you've had wild rice, you probably actually haven't, which I know sounds crazy, because, you know, wild rice has been pulled from its natural environments and selectively bred to create what's known as paddy rice, which is basically a agricultural, you know, monocrop grown sometimes in Minnesota, but a lot of it is grown in California. So basically, if you've bought wild rice and it is black or a very, very, very dark brown, that's paddy rice. That's not actual wild rice. Although to be fair, some native communities do grow paddy rice in addition to harvesting it wild. If you want true wild rice, well, you're lucky if you live in Minnesota, it's sold at Whole Foods. But otherwise, you can actually look into the tribal nations in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. I went to the White Earth Nation, and actually, if you just look up their tribal website, there is a link to buy their own hand-harvested tribal wild rice right on their tribal website too. So you can order direct from them. I actually just did. I actually just ordered a 1 pound bag. It's about $15 for a pound.
All right, Sarah, tell us about the remarkable journey of peanuts from their origins, I guess, in South America to a crop that really is essential now on multiple continents.
Yeah, it truly is remarkable. Peanuts are indigenous to what is today South America, to an area known as the Pantanal, which is the largest wetlands in the world. And from there, they went via the Columbian Exchange. That is the movement of plants and animals from the Americas into Europe and then Africa and Asia. So peanuts were one of the crops that were transported. By the time Christopher Columbus and the other conquistadors were coming, peanuts were being grown in the Caribbean by the Arawak people and other communities. They went to Europe, they went into Africa, where, okay, I mean, I should say this is the crazy part. Peanuts are a beautiful plant. They grow in a very unique way. They flower, and then the flower sends down this thing called a peduncle into the ground. It's like a just like a green, tiny green vine that grows from the flower and back into the ground. And on the end of that tiny green vine grows the peanut. And there's only one other plant in the world that grows that way. It's called the Bambara groundnut. And that plant is found in West Africa, which is where the peanut ended up after its long journey across the ocean. And so the local farmers were like, we get this plant. They like the taste of it. It was also a more productive plant than the Bambara groundnut, became and still is a huge part of West African cuisine. Then, during the trafficking of Africans during the slave trade, enslaved traffic Africans were brought to the Americas. Peanuts were used to feed people on boats because they were familiar, had they're very shelf stable, and then they were almost exclusively grown in the gardens of the enslaved, really through the early to mid 19th century, still being a key part of African American culture as well.
And these could be a key way for some enslaved people to earn a modicum of independence, right? Occasionally they were allowed to grow their own peanuts and sell them.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the enslaved were really required to have their own gardens because part of the deal was, yes, you got some rations, but it was never enough to actually keep the family fed. So these gardens often had many African crops, and if they had the time and the space, they also would grow plants that the enslavers were interested in and sell it back to the enslavers, including peanuts. So they could get paid for the produce they were growing, or they could get a pass to go sell produce in the cities on Sundays. And that's where you would get peanut vendors selling roasted peanuts who were enslaved but could make their own money this way. Or the groundnut women. The groundnut women were famous too. The groundnut cake women were famous in Charleston, and they made a very special candy with the peanut that I talk about in the book, the Charleston runner peanut, which is the peanut that was grown here really until the mid 19th century. Like very, very deep, intense flavor, sweet, great for confectionery. And they used these roasted peanuts in a little candy that was made from brown sugar and molasses.
So these runner peanuts, the Carolina runner peanuts, are the ones that may be endangered. If they're so delicious, why are they not the primary varietal that is sold?
Well, I mean, it was coming back to this commercial agricultural system. They're kind of a small peanut, and so they were difficult to hand harvest. And then once mechanized peanut machinery was introduced, they were too small for the machines. So as more peanut varieties were sought out from South America and then propagated here in North America, they fell out of favor because even though they were the most delicious, there were other ones that were easier to grow. And so by the 1930s, they weren't going in the ground anymore, and they were actually believed to be extinct. Not just functionally extinct, which means maybe someone's got them in a garden, maybe they're in a seed bank, but they were thought to no longer exist on this planet.
But we can grow them, right? You tried.
I did because of a man named David Shields, who was sort of charged with the task of hunting down lost crops of the South. And it took him 15 years, but finally, one phone call, he found 24 of these peanuts in a seed bank in North Carolina. And they were basically, he talked the owner into giving him half, and they put them in the ground and they grew. So now it has been grown out, but really the only way to taste them is, yeah, at this point, to try growing them yourself. Because they're still too small for the machinery, we haven't seen them come back on any commercial scale or even any localized scale yet. It's really been a struggle, for the farmers who are trying to, repatriate these crops.
At the end of the book, you remind us that if we start paying attention, we will probably discover some kind of endangered ingredient not too far from where we live. How do we track these things down, and how do we make sure that we're contributing to keeping them in production?
Yeah, so Lark a Taste. You know, it's divided by region. You can search where you are. And, you know, I write about it in my introduction. My first and most surprising interaction with an endangered food was when I was driving through Ohio with my mom and saw a Texas Longhorn cattle sitting in a field, which is, of course, Texas's, you know, probably most famous agricultural symbol, but they're actually highly endangered. There is maybe about 1,000 registered animals worldwide. And they fell out of favor because even though they were really good foragers and sort of really great for the homesteading era of Texas, once we began doing most of the slaughtering in the Midwest, you know, animals were rounded up and put on train cars and sent to Chicago. Their horns were too big to fit in those train cars. So again, it was this idea of the food system changed and they were sort of left behind. So how do you engage in it? I mean, some people engage in it in that they have land. So they put some Texas Longhorn cattle on it. But then from those farmers, you can also buy Texas Longhorn meat. You can also donate to organizations on the front lines, like the Livestock Conservancy. They are the ones who monitor species like Texas Longhorn cattle and make sure their numbers are stable, as well as implement breeding programs that make sure they're going to be around for a long way to come, long time to come.
Sarah Lohman is a food historian and author of the book Endangered Eating: America's Vanishing Foods. Sarah, thank you so much for the conversation.
Oh, it was my pleasure. I hope this inspires some people to get out there and try some, you know, amazing local American rare endangered foods.
Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.